Matthew chapter 24. Jesus is in the final week of his life before the cross. The religious leaders have tried to publicly trap him and order to humiliate him. They were unsuccessful all three times because of their failure to be broken and accept the rebuke and the brokenness that the Lord was trying to bring into their life. They represented a danger, not only to the multitudes, but to the Lord's disciples. And so he spends chapter 23 publicly denouncing them and exposing their sin and exposing them for what they really were. And God, of course, knows what all of us really are. I'm not interested in any such exposure. So keep breaking me, Lord, and he does. Chapter 23 ends with Jesus' lament over the unwillingness of Jerusalem, by and large, to recognize him for who he was and for keeping him from being the protector that he desired to be for them as a city and as a people. And then Jesus declared concerning your house, he says to them, speaking of the temple, that it would be left desolate, referring to the destruction of the temple. It is Jesus' prophecy or declaration concerning the upcoming... Tom, I hardly recognize you back there. God bless you, brother. He's way back there. Whew. Tom must have got here late. I'm all thrown off. Who else isn't in your proper seat here tonight? You were trying for that seat, weren't you, Bay? You were trying for that load seat. Anyway, I like this man. I'm distracted easily by him. But it's Jesus' prophecy concerning the destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple that produces the question within the hearts and the minds of the disciples that they asked to begin chapter 24. It was absolutely inconceivable to the disciples. I heard that beep. Anybody else hear that? Okay. Okay. Let's all just settle down. Take a deep breath. So I'll just take a deep breath. Take it from me. If you don't need it for you, take it from me. Just settle. By the time Jesus speaks of the destruction of the temple, Herod's temple, and it was the third temple that had been built for the Jews in that region of Mount Moriah. There was Solomon's temple, and then there was the temple under Zerubbabel, and then there was this temple. The temple had been 50 years in the building. Up to the time that Jesus makes the prophecy, they are going to build it and continue to build that temple and that Temple Mount region for right up to within 7 years of its destruction. And when Jesus declared that the temple would be destroyed, it was inconceivable to them. Who, in the worst case scenario, would come in and conquer us as a people, as the Jews, they would be thinking, and would ever come in and destroy the temple? One of the most amazing buildings in the history of mankind. Herod was an unbelievable builder. And if the Jews were conquered, or if Jerusalem was conquered, then surely whoever conquered it would not destroy anything so valuable as the temple. They may take it and use it for their purposes. They may defile it. They may do a lot of things to it, but completely destroy it. They couldn't understand it. But all their minds began to spin as it related to all of these things. And so that's the background for the questions that they ask in chapter 24, verse 1. And then Jesus, following his declaration concerning the temple and his public denunciation of the unrepentant religious leaders of his day, went out and he departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. I said, well, wait a second, not so fast. Let's give you a tour of this place. Look at these buildings, the temple itself and the buildings associated with the temple. And Jesus said to them and to us as disciples, do you not see all these things, all these buildings? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. The disciples are completely impressed with this building and the buildings of man, and Jesus is unimpressed with it. In fact, he declares that not one of these stones is going to be left one upon the other. The temple was built, again, as I said, 50 years in the building of it up to this point in time. The area covered 13 acres on what is called the Temple Mount today. Much of it was made of white limestone that was then covered with marble and covered with gold. One of the rabbis wrote in the Talmud, that never saw the Temple of Herod, never saw a fine building. Some of the foundation stones associated with the temple area were 40 feet long, that's the length of this room, 12 feet wide, and 20 feet tall. You've got a single stone that is half the size of this room. And if you go to Jerusalem today, they've opened up what is called the Rabbi's Tunnel now, and you can take tours down in there, and they show you some of these foundation stones that made up that early Temple Mount area. Some of those stones weighed up to 165 tons. Now you stop and think about that. That's quite a foundation for any building. You begin to think to yourself, who in the world, under what motivation, would ever bother knocking stones that size, one from on top of the other, if they were even inclined to destroy the temple? And yet Jesus said, not one stone will be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. The stones, the temple looked immovable, looked like it was sure, looked like it was something that was going to last to the end of the age, but it wasn't. And what's true of that building is true of this world. But it seemed impossible to them. And yet within 40 years of Jesus's, or about 40 years after Jesus' declaration, this prophecy to these disciples, a rebellion began in the nation of Israel. The Roman government brought in a series of governors over the area of Israel that were insensitive to the sensitivities, the religious sensitivities of the Jews. And they did one blunder after another in terms of stirring up the nationalistic identity of the Jews, the hatred of the Gentiles ruling over them, and then bringing in all of their worship of their, all of their things related to their staves and all of this kind of stuff. One foolish thing after another by these Roman governors, until finally the Jews rebelled against the Roman Empire. Didn't rebel against them in the 300s ADs, when Rome might have been weak enough to rebel against. They rebel against Rome while Rome is still growing as a power. In 70 AD, Rome wasn't going to let go of anything or anyone that they had control of, much less the Middle East. Just on principle, they weren't going to be shown up, because that would be the undoing of their empire. And that empire was going to go on for another 300 or so years. So they had no chance in their rebellion, but they rebelled against the Romans on the basis of religious principle. And finally, as the war went on, it began to concentrate further and further down until the focus was upon Jerusalem and finally upon the temple area itself. And when the Jews rebelled against Rome and held out their rebellion for a protracted period of time by Roman standards, finally the Roman Empire dispatched a general by the name of Titus, who brought with him the 12th and the 5th and the 10th Roman legions. And can you imagine, if you've been to Jerusalem or seen videos of that, watching three Roman legions come over those hills, and they're going to take care of you. And they came over and they began to lay siege to the city of Jerusalem. And the battle was a long battle. It was a bloody battle. It was a cruel battle on both sides. Josephus records it in his, the Jewish historian, in his records of the thing, and he was an eyewitness of it. Atrocities committed on both sides, guerrilla warfare on both sides. And so there was this long siege, there were long battles, there were bloody battles, there were fires, there were stones, there were arrows, the dead were told, laid out, one after another, as far as you could look, like a carpet. Over a million Jews. And by some estimates, 1.6 million Jews died in Jerusalem. The taking of Jerusalem, not only at the hands of the Romans, but of the hands of fellow Jews that were running wild in terms of gangs within the city. When the whole thing was over, there was all of million plus Jews had been killed. And in this long battle, the Romans against the Jews here, the Romans far from home, the not, you know, being happy about being drawn into this kind of a battle, the effect upon the Roman soldier. It had been a long battle. It had been a discouraging battle. They'd seen many of their friends die in the battles and war. It was a slower process in those days. There was the siege, and there was the running out of water, and then the running out of food, and then the attack, and then the siege mounds that were put up against the walls. And it was a long, messy ordeal that they went through in trying to take that city. And all of that was necessary just to get to your enemy. By the time the Romans broke through into Jerusalem, they were seething. And even Titus could not control his troops at that particular point. He had sent messengers in to speak to the leaders of the Jews and had told them, surrender. Surrender. We don't want to destroy your city. And we don't want to destroy the temple. Not only did he not want to destroy the temple, he didn't even want to defile it. Titus wanted the temple to continue. It had been built by a Roman, Herod himself. And so he pled with them, but they were unwilling to listen to him, unwilling to surrender, unwilling to come out even into the open to fight, which you can understand that. But he was refused by the Jews. And when they finally broke through, one of the Roman soldiers threw a torch, a flame, into the temple that was now filled with people. And the flames began to burn the temple, and the fire became so hot within the temple that it burned all of the gold within the temple, and the gold melted down into the cracks of the stones. And because a soldier many times in ancient times, part of his pay was the loot that he would recover from the victory over a particular enemy. When all of that gold melted down into the cracks of these great stones, it didn't matter how big a stone was, they knocked one and every one of them off of the other, 165 tons or no, in order to get to the gold to them. And they took those stones and they rolled them off on the western side of the Temple Mount down into what is called the Triopian Valley, which is been excavated today, and it was a region where the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall is now, and they had this beautiful thick stones that constituted a walkway that the Romans had built there, and when they threw these stones down, it just crushed them like little rocks, and all of that's being excavated and open to see today. And Josephus later wrote, he said, by the time they were through, if you did not know that there was a temple there, you would have never guessed that there was a temple there. There was not one stone left upon another, exactly as Jesus had said. When Jesus prophesies concerning man's future, he doesn't guess. He doesn't get a warm feeling and then say whatever comes to his mind. When he sat and spoke to them there in the region of the Temple Mount, and when he speaks to them on the Mount of Olives concerning the end of the age, he sees it before his eyes. He knows exactly what it is that's going to happen. And he knows that what was true of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD is going to be true of the whole world in one day. All of it's going to be destroyed. All of it's going to be brought down. And the rebellion against Rome was leveled. The rebellion against God will also be leveled. That temple looked so sure. It looked so strong. It looked like even his disciples couldn't believe that there's going to be an end to that temple. Look how long they've been building it. And it's easy for God's people to look at this world and say, we've been thousands of years in the building of it. It's a sure thing. Somehow we'll make do. Somehow this won't come to an end. But when the Lord says it's going to come to an end, it's going to come to an end. There's no more sure than that temple. And so why spend so much time on that early prophecy here in Matthew chapter 24? Because that's my way. And I have the microphone. No. It's for us to be reminded as his people all the way to the end of the age that as sure as that prophecy concerning Jerusalem was, so sure is every single prophecy that follows in the remainder of this chapter. And now verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, so they have crossed the Kidron Valley from the Temple Mount area over onto the Mount of Olives. It's a beautiful place, able to look out and view all of the buildings there on the Temple Mount. And while he sat there on the Mount of Olives, and this chapter 24 and chapter 25 is called the Olivet Discourse of Jesus because it was given on the Mount of Olives, and it is his second longest teaching that he gave next to the Sermon on the Mount. So he sits on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? What are these things? Notice in verse 2, Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things concerning the temple and all? When will these things be? That is the destruction of the temple. But they don't ask just one question. They ask a second question. And the second question is, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? In the mind of the disciples, the destruction of the temple and the return of Jesus and the end of the age had to be all one thing. I mean, they couldn't think of it as being two separate events. And so they posed the two questions. And then my looking at this particular chapter, Jesus largely ignores the first question in terms of the destruction of the temple and seems to focus most of all upon the end of the age. And I'll show you why in just a little bit. And little bit is, of course, a relative term. And then in verse 4, Jesus answered and said to them concerning now what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age. He said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Jesus is talking about the signs of the times or the birth pangs leading up to the end. Leading up to the Great Tribulation, he addresses, as I understand the passage, he is addressing the characteristics of the world as it moves toward that end. You notice in verse 8 what he describes from verse 4 through verse 8. He calls those the beginning of sorrows, the birth pangs. These are the things that are going to be happening in the world as a whole that is going to be leading toward this time. And then after that, he begins to talk about the first part of the Great Tribulation and then the second half of the Great Tribulation. So he says one of the characteristics that we're moving toward that end is going to be widespread spiritual deception. It's interesting that Jesus speaks about these false Christs coming along and deceiving many. And apparently they're the kind of person that says, listen, Jesus was an anointed one. Jesus was an anointed teacher. He was one of the great masters. But We are a great master in that lineage or whatever it might be. And so they come along, they use Jesus in his name in order to build their own little trip on it, but they're false prophets and they're going to deceive many. So more than the wars and the rumors of wars and all these kinds of things, he talks about spiritual deception. Why would he talk about that before he would talk about wars and rumors of wars? We tend to look at things and say, nothing could be worse than a war. Nothing could be worse than a revolution within a country. And there is something worse than that. And the thing that's worse than that is spiritual deception. Because as bad as a war is and as bad as a revolution is within a country, the consequences are temporal. They are not eternal. To be spiritually deceived, to be pulled away from the truth that is found in God, that has eternal consequences. And because it does, it is infinitely more serious than anything that happens on a purely physical realm. And so we have, in some way here, this false teachers, the spiritual deception that's happening. And of course, for spiritual deception to happen within the world, there has to be a moving away from the Word of God being the standard, that is the Bible being the standard of the doctrine and practice of people in this world. And so there'll be this religious deception. And then he said in verse 6, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. And so there's going to be wars, actual wars, and there's going to be rumors of wars, and as a sign of birth pangs moving more and more toward the end of the age. It's interesting when you look at the world today, and over in Luke it talks about revolution and all concerning these things, and you have the wars, that's nation fighting against nation, but then you have the revolutions where you have the fighting, the insurrection within a nation. Look at the world and tell me, how many stable governments are there? I mean, this sphere called planet Earth, it is in chaos. Remember, the Bible was not written to Americans. It was, but not to us supremely. So we tend to look and say, our government is somewhat stable. Our society is somewhat stable. But when the people of the rest of the world read this, they're in the middle of this entire continents. That from one week to the next, nobody knows who's going to be running that country, and the people paying a terrible price for what's happening. So the wars and the rumors of war and all of that stuff that's going on. It's interesting, I heard some statistics recently in terms of how well armed the world is, and it's fascinating. If you think that this world is headed for peace, I don't know what book you read in life and newspaper and these kinds of things. One Trident sub in the United States arsenal with its 20-some missiles with the nuclear capability associated with it. One submarine in our arsenal has 40 times the firepower of everything that was exploded in the entirety of World War II on all sides, from every bullet to every mine to every mortar to every piece of artillery to the two bombs that went off in Japan, the atom bombs. You take everything by every Russian, every American, all of the French, all of the Japanese, all across the board, everywhere that war went on, and just one submarine carries 40 times that firepower today. It's estimated today that there are 32 million men in active military service in the world today, worldwide. And there are an additional 570 million in reserve. Over 40% of the world's spending is spent on weapons. 50% of the world's scientists and engineers and physicists spend all of their time working on weapons. The United States alone has the ability to wipe out all life on planet Earth, except cockroaches. They'll survive. But the United States of America alone has the ability to wipe out all life on planet Earth 4 times. The Russians have the ability to wipe out all life on planet Earth 5 times. Why are we not concerned about that? Our delivery systems are better. Our delivery systems are better. But this world is armed to the teeth. This is not a world that is preparing for peace. It's not a world that in the upper echelons of what's going on in mankind that is expecting peace in the long term as it relates to the world. And so he warns that there will be the wars, the rumors of wars. And then here is the purpose of telling us these characteristics of the last days. It's so that when we see these things, we won't be troubled. We will be reminded as we sang. What a wonderful group of songs for what we're looking at tonight. That our God, we see him seated on a throne, high and lifted up. His is the throne behind all thrones, all of man's thrones. He's the one that's in charge of everything. No matter how bad it gets here, every one of his promises toward us as his children is going to be yea and amen. Not one of them is going to fail in any way. So he lets us know so that we can read the newspaper without too much medication. And so he says, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. And here you have nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, so the insurrection within the countries. And then he says there will be famines, and we see the increase of famines all over the world, part of it associated with the population explosion that continues to go on in the world, and at least in what is called the third world today, like the first world is something spectacular, but we know what the term means, and of course, so much of the ability to raise the crops and all affected by the wars. It's estimated today that on an annual basis, 30 million babies die every year in the world of famine. That's just the babies. That's not counting their moms and their dads and others around the world. And so famine. And then pestilences, which is diseases. And of course, we continue to look at this AIDS epidemic, fascinating again to in kind of a tragic way to watch the AIDS conference that they have every year. And again, they have written off the continent of Africa. They've just written it off. They just, we only have so much money, let's not even send it there because we're not going to be able to make a dent in what it is that they see coming down there in Africa. And you have sections of Africa and sections of different other parts of the world where now there are not enough able-bodied men and women who are in that age where they're strong enough to bring in the harvest and these kinds of things. And you've got this cycle that is just going to go downward because it's their one, you know, cash crop and they don't have enough able bodies to bring the crop in. And so the AIDS, and we read about just recently, I was reading in the Chronicle, and they were talking about these deadly bacterias now that are becoming resistant to this drug of last resort that we have, these antibiotics that we have that are supposed to be the super antibiotics that can knock out anything. They're being used increasingly. If you have a physician that you go to and all you have to do is say, I think I need a prescription, and they give you some kind of an antibiotic, don't even know whether you have a virus or you have an infection or you have what, or the antibiotic can work against it, and all of this medication that's going out in a way that has never gone out before in my lifetime, and what it's doing is that it's producing these, you know, new resistant strains of these diseases. They're very concerned about the tuberculosis. Nobody wants to take people with TB and put them in sanatoriums anymore in order to make sure that they take their medication, get cured of the TB before they're back in the general population. But they'll take the medication, part way of their medication through the battery of taking it, and then they'll stop, and then it never gets knocked out, never gets killed, but it develops now an ability to fight against the antibiotic. And now they're concerned about the ability to control TB worldwide. Now they're concerned about planes because they're so crowded and the amount of TB that is now on the plains, and all on and on it goes. You know, remember that Ebola virus that just turns people into jelly, you know, when they get it and all that, what a horrendous kind of way. That's still there. And we don't know what's coming next. Life is very fragile on planet Earth. Life is very fragile. And so Jesus warns of the famines, the pestilences, the diseases, and earthquakes in various places. I heard today, I was here at church and heard about an earthquake in my old stomping grounds there in Napa. They had a 5.5 or something like that, and heard about that. And I didn't even know that there was a fault that went through Napa. But there's so many faults going all over the place that when, you know, you an earthquake happens, you don't even know whose fault it is. Listen. Earthquake humor isn't easy to pull off. That's the best I can do with that. But it's all the crisscrossing, and it is this documented thing today where the increase of just somehow the movement of the plates of the earth increasing, you know, geometrically in these last couple of decades. And Jesus said concerning all of this, all these are the beginning of sorrows. All these are the birth pangs. So this isn't the end of the age. This is just what leads to it. Now, and so we understand that as things move toward their climax, things are going to get worse before they get better. And it's very appropriate that he uses this imagery of birth pangs in all of this, because what's happening is all of this that's going on in the world is moving toward a birth. And the birth is going to occur at the second coming of the Lord Jesus, and there will be the birth of the kingdom of God in the sense of the millennial reign, him coming in, establishing his kingdom upon the earth. But between now and then, it's going to get difficult because of the rebellion of people against God. But one of the things about birth pains, you know, you get, what are they called, the Braxton Hicks or something that kind of happened there to begin with and everything and all. And sometimes, you know, the first baby, you think it's not going to get much worse than this. But one of the things that happens is once those birth pangs start to settle in, once those contractions hit, what do? They increase in frequency, they increase in intensity, and once they're in full gear, there is no turning around. I'd never want to give birth to a child. Not in my current condition. I'd at least want to be a woman. But anyway, but even as a woman, I mean, there you are in this thing. God's got to give you the grace. Here you go. This thing just starts to hit and all, and it's like you've been strapped into some crazy ride at Great America. It started to go. They can't stop the thing now to save your life. You got to ride it out all the way to the end. Listen, I'm bringing out all of my greatest fears in life before you. Don't laugh at me. But that's the way that it is. Once this thing kicks in, there's just no turning back. And so there's going to be the increase. And then in verse 9, I believe he starts to talk about the first 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation period here. He says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Now, one of the things that will happen is, following the rapture of the church prior to the Great Tribulation, or prior to the 7-year tribulation at all, because the first seal that's broken in Revelation chapter 6 that constitutes the pouring out of the wrath of God upon the earth is the revelation of the Antichrist. And that begins the tribulation period. At the end of chapter 6, in response to all of the seals being broken, the people are hiding themselves, and they're trying to hide themselves from the wrath of the Lamb. All of those seals constitute the wrath of God against a Christ-rejecting world. The Bible teaches that as Christians, we are not appointed to wrath. Jesus bore the wrath for our sins on the cross of Calvary. And no one in the ancient world and their system of judgment, no one would ever be forced to pay a sentence twice for their sin or for their crime. And so we'll be raptured out. But one of the greatest harvests into the kingdom of God occurs during the tribulation period. where we're told later in the book of Revelation, and I think that Jesus in Matthew chapter 24, as he lays these things out, he's laying out some general things and all in answer to their question, knowing that the details are going to be given to the Apostle John in the writing of the Revelation. But there in the Revelation, as that rapture occurs, and then a great number of people, we're told, they are without number, unable to number them, come to know the Lord. They lose their life for their faith in the Lord. They find themselves up in heaven. John asks, who are these? And the angel explains to them, these are those that have come out of the great tribulation. And so what happens, the church gets raptured out of the earth, and God's wrath begins to get poured out, and all of a sudden people begin to realize that you were right in what you were saying. And the light begins to go on that Jesus was indeed the Messiah. And it's going to be interesting to see how full the churches are in the world the first Sunday after the rapture. And they're going to get there and, you know, start to add some things up and start to grab some of those tracts out of the back, you know, literature racks and start to get things. But no one that's a believer will be able to take the mark of the beast. And ultimately, during the tribulation period, the Antichrist will not allow anyone to buy or sell without the mark of the beast. And anyone without the mark of the beast will be martyred for their faith. Well, who in all of the world is going to be unwilling to take his mark to buy and sell? Only Christians. Everyone else, it's like, if this is what I've got to do to eat, this is what I'll do to eat. But the Christian will understand that no one gets into the kingdom of God bearing that mark. And so ultimately they'll be identified and be martyred for their faith and hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and betray one another and will hate one another. And many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, probably talking about false prophets in general, but certainly the false prophet that was kind of the right-hand man to the Antichrist, rising up, doing his miracles, deceiving many. And because lawlessness will abound, the world will become a scene of widespread crime, and lawlessness will abound. The love of many will grow cold. And so we see even that as part of just kind of rolling toward that end. There's entire parts of the world today where the government cannot control the crime within the country. Sometimes it seems like we're not far from that, but we're quite far from that compared to other parts. There are parts of the world where the military of the nation takes control of the country by day and then loses it that night and has to regain it by the day. And in this country, of course, we're building prisons like there's no tomorrow. But just don't put the Ten Commandments in them. All right, okay. I don't want to go there. I want to go there, but I'm not going to go there. And then Jesus said, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. And so to be one of those saints in the tribulation, it's going to be at most likely some will survive the tribulation period, but very few, comparatively speaking. And it'll be at probably persecution right unto death. And so here is the encouragement to endure all the way to the end. Don't even think of apostasy as an option in the face of that hostility. Be faithful to the end and you'll be saved, that is delivered. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. A lot of people look at that verse and they say, Jesus Christ can't come back until we've evangelized the entire world. I'm all for world evangelization. But it is interesting to note that in the book of Revelation, there'll be 144,000 male virgin Jews, 144,000 Billy Grahams that will be preaching the gospel to the world. There will be the two witnesses, probably Elijah and Moses, that will have tremendous television time as they torment the world with their righteousness. Imagine that righteousness will torment the world during that first 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. They will be preaching the gospel, and then we're told in the book of Revelation, in chapter 14 that an angel will go forth throughout the whole world declaring the everlasting gospel. And so even during the Great Tribulation period, people will hear the gospel, have an opportunity to respond and be responsible for the decision that they make. And then in verse 15, he begins to prophesy, it appears, concerning the second 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation period. When Jesus says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand." And so he speaks of this abomination that causes desolation that will occur. Now, Daniel spoke of this abomination that causes desolation in Daniel chapter 9. And what it is that the Antichrist will go into the rebuilt temple. He makes a covenant with the Jews, Daniel chapter 9. And in making that covenant with the Jews for a 7-year period, that he makes that covenant with them, he breaks the covenant halfway through the 7 years, at the 3.5-year mark. He allows them to rebuild the temple because Jesus declares that this abomination that causes desolation, when you see that in the holy place, at this point in time, there is no holy place. There is no temple in Jerusalem. So it necessitates the rebuilding of the temple. The Antichrist will allow the Jews to rebuild their temple. He will be quite a diplomat because somehow this is going to work out with the Muslims in all of this. Obviously, he's going to give them something too. The sacrifices are going to be reinstituted. The worship of the Lord, the temple worship is going to be reinstituted at that point. And then at the 3.5-year mark, the Antichrist is going to walk into the Holy of Holies, sit down, declare himself to be God, and demand to be worshipped as God. It is the abomination that causes desolation because he enters into the Holy of Holies where only God himself is allowed in terms of his presence. And by entering in, he defiles it and he makes the place an abomination. But he not only makes it an abomination, but he makes and produces a desolation. The Jews will, up to that point in time, look at the Antichrist as being their Messiah. Remember, Jesus spoke to the Jews in their rejection of him. He said, "I've come in my own name, you've rejected me. Another will come in his own name, him you will receive." And you go to the Israel today, and it's not uncommon to find, if you ask Jews how they will recognize their Messiah who is to come, and they say, "He will allow us to rebuild our temple." And so the whole nation is set up for the coming of the Antichrist. But when the Antichrist goes into the Holy of Holies, the light will go on by and large for the Jews that they have followed the wrong guy, that they have been terribly deceived. And then Jesus tells them, "Get out of there." He said, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. He's not talking about Christians here. How many Christians are in Judea? Very few Christians in Judea. All of this is Jewish. He's writing to Jews during the Great Tribulation period. He said, when you see this happen, then if you're in Judea, then run to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Of course, in Jerusalem and in that area of the Middle East, the housetops are flat. They garden on the top of it. They do all kinds of things. It's another room up on the top of the house. And so, again, that speaking of the narrowness of the area of Judea. He said, listen, when this happens, if you're on the housetop, don't come down to take anything out of the house. There won't even be time to grab your picture albums or whatever you might want to grab because, I mean, every second is going to mean the difference between life and death. And let him who is in the field not go back to his house to get his clothes. Run, and woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. It'll make it harder to flee, and pray that your flight will not be in winter or on the Sabbath. So again, a Jewish reference. No Christian is concerned about fleeing or running or going anywhere on the Sabbath, but the Jews are because they were supposed to only go a certain distance according to the law in order to obey the law of the Sabbath. And so he begins to speak to them, to pray related to these things, anything that would hinder their fleeing, for then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. It is that verse in verse 21 that makes us realize that what he's talking about, there are some who look at this and say that this is a reference to Titus's destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. But verse 21 makes us realize that far worse things had happened in man's history than even the atrocities that happened there in Jerusalem. It's talking about a future time that is worse than anything that we've ever seen. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Now we know from the book of Revelation that when the Jews recognize this concerning the Antichrist, that in the Antichrist tries to destroy the Jews at this point, they flee toward the Judean wilderness, more specifically to the rock city of Petra. The Antichrist sends an army out after them. The Lord opens up the earth, does something supernatural to destroy the armies in order to protect the Jews that then find a place of refuge there for the final 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. And so if the days of that Great Tribulation, if they hadn't been shortened, if Jesus didn't return at the end of it and bring an end to it, then no flesh would have survived. But what Jesus said, for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Now, when people see in verse 22 the elect mentioned there, they sometimes automatically think that that is must be a reference to Christians and that that puts Christians in the Great Tribulation. Now, I refer you and anyone that wants to tear into this with real depth to check out my tape on the rapture pre or post-trib concerning a more thorough handling of that. But in the Scriptures, the elect are not always Christians. The Jews in the Old Testament were continually referred to as the elect. Christians are referred to as the elect. The tribulation saints, later in the New Testament, or there, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. And so this right-hand man, the false prophet associated with the Antichrist, he's going to do all kinds of signs and wonders. He's going to wow the world. But those that are founded in the Word of God, give their lives to the Lord, they won't be fooled by it. And Jesus warns them not to be. As he says in verse 25, "See, I have told you beforehand. And therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, the Messiah, he's in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he's in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming." "For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." So he says, listen, it's going to be a chaotic time. And I say, listen, he's out here in the desert. He's over in this hiding place. Come on out of the rock city of Petra. And he's right over here. And Jesus says, don't believe it. It's interesting how many groups through the years and the Jehovah Witnesses and some of their prophecies concerning the return of the Lord. And they prophesied the day that the Lord would return. And then when those prophecies didn't come to pass, finally after one false prophecy after another, they said, well, he's here, but he's in a secret room out in the desert. I think I would have chosen something slightly different than that terminology in the light of Matthew chapter 24. But Jesus said, listen, don't have anyone fool you into thinking that when I come back, you're going to have to take desert tours to see me. He said here in verse 27, he said, you're not going to need to have a prophet to become aware of my return, all you're going to need is your own two eyes. He said it's going to be like lightning from the east that flashes to the west. In other words, everyone is going to know when he returns at his second coming. And then associated with that second coming, for wherever the carcass is, that is dead bodies, there the eagles or birds of prey will be gathered together. And Jesus, when he makes his return at his second coming, he comes from his heavenly throne. He makes his way to the Mount of Olives, where he's going to set down his foot on the Mount of Olives and then enter into Jerusalem. But on his way, he stops in a certain valley called Armageddon, where all of the armies of the world are gathered together, first of all, to fight against themselves. But then, as they start to fight against themselves, they look up and say, there's someone we hate more than one another, and they turn to fight against the Lord. It's a very one-sided battle. Jesus, with the word of his mouth, it wiped out. The blood as high as a horse's bridle there in the valley of Megiddo. And so a reference, it appears in verse 28, to that, the carcasses and the birds of prey coming in to feast upon that. And immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. So cataclysms in the heavenlies. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the earth to the other. And so those that have survived the great tribulation that know him, and also the Jews that have survived that great tribulation period. And then in verse 32, he begins to talk about, continues to talk about these things, and I think in the context of the church. And so he says, now learn. Remember, when he's speaking to these Jewish believers, these disciples that have asked him this question, he's speaking to men who are Jews, but he's also speaking to men who are Christians. And so he addresses this in the light of the Jews in this early part of the sermon, and now he addresses it for them as Christians. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. And you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the very doors. And assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things are fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And so Jesus, speaking of this tree, this fig tree, and this budding forth of the fig tree, and when you see its leaves as being tender, or its branches tender, as leaves are coming forth, that you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it, what is this it? It is what they have asked there in verse 3, remember, where they said, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? They asked, what will be the end of the age? He said, here is what will be the end of the age. When you see all of these things, you know that it, that is the end of the age, is near at the very doors. And then he talks about the generation that the generation that sees these things will by no means pass away till all of these things are fulfilled. A couple of different interpretations as it relates to that passage. The word generation, when it talks there in verse 34, talks about this generation. Genea is the word in the original language. And the word can mean a couple of different things. It can mean an age. It can mean a generation. Or it can also mean a nationality or a people. And so you have people who look at this passage concerning the parable of the fig tree, and they say that Jesus is speaking of the nation of Israel because one of the Old Testament figures of the nation of Israel is the fig tree. And so he's saying that the generation that sees the rebirth of the nation of Israel, that that generation or that group of people will not pass away until they see the total fulfillment of all of these prophecies. And so, when Israel was reborn as a nation in 1948, there were a lot of the people in the prophetic realm. They looked and they said, all right, what is a generation biblically? Well, the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years for a whole generation to die off. And so they say a generation is 40 years. You add the 40 years to the 1948, you come up with 1988. You subtract the 7 from the 1988 and you come up with 1981. And everyone was scared to death, you know, I'm looking for the Lord's return. 1981, Karen and I got saved in 1980. It had no effect upon us at all in terms of things. But there was tremendous excitement. But one of the problems is that when that date passed, it disillusioned a lot of people. So a lot of people look and they said, all right, well, that kind of passed. And they missed that a little bit. And so, the Jews, they became a nation in 1948, but they never had control of Jerusalem until 1967. So you add 40 to 1967, and you end up with 2007. You subtract 7. Listen, I'm not saying anything. But I mean, that's kind of the thing that goes on. And so there's a bit of a, you know, looking for this year. Is that kind of thing? And that's one way that it's interpreted. But the word can also refer to a nationality, and Jesus could very well be saying that the Jews as a people would not cease to exist all the way through to the end of all of this. And it is interesting that the Jews are a miracle of man's history. There has never been a nationality of people who have survived unabsorbed by the nations that they are in over 5 generations. And the Jews survived and maintained their national identity for over 2,000 years until the time that the nation of Israel was reborn. And so, you know, as someone has observed, you know, when's the last time you saw a Hittite? Or, you know, Ammonite or whatever, the Uptites, Outasites, Termites. When was the last time you've seen these? Well, you haven't. They got absorbed. But the Jews, who were without a homeland far longer than any of them, have survived. And perhaps a reference to this prophecy. And Jesus said in verse 36, but of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So the time of the rapture of the church, nobody knows. But the Father, not even anyone that writes a book about it in a given year. And so when somebody says, the Lord's coming back on such and such a day and all, you just turn right to here and say, no one knows the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, but only, the Father knows. Well, you know, if we're not here to take pot shots at the time of the rapture, what are we supposed to do? Well, we're supposed to watch and wait. He said, as in the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, and so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. And so one of the characteristics, in addition to, you know, widespread sin and wickedness among the people of the world in the time of Noah, but one of the characteristics of that age is that they were giving themselves entirely to the issues of life, and the flood or the judgment came upon them as a complete surprise. And so it will upon the world at the time that the Great Tribulation begins. And then he tells us, as a result of that, we are not to be like the world. We are to be watching and waiting for the Lord's return. Verse 43, but know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore you also, and note the word watched in verse 43, and then here, Be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect. If you know that a thief is going to break into your house, what are you going to do? You're going to watch and wait for him. How much more to wait and watch for the Lord's return? Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. And so, two kinds of servants. When the Lord returns, one will be watching and waiting. That's the blessed servant. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and to drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on him in a day when he is not looking for him, and in an hour when he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites, and there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So you have two kinds of servants. You have one that is watching and waiting for the Lord's return, and then you have one that isn't. And the one that isn't, as a result of their failure to watch and to wait for the Lord's return, he becomes slothful. He becomes slothful, and he becomes engaged in sin. One of the great things, and you look, and God has always wanted his people all down through the ages. From the very beginning, 2,000 years ago, he wanted his people to be expecting Jesus Christ to return at any time. And you say, oh, what a bummer. I mean, there they were watching and waiting their whole life, and he didn't come. Ah, but there are benefits to watching and waiting in our lives as Christians. And one of the things that it does in our lives, whether he returns in our lifetime or he doesn't, is it produces a needed urgency within our life for the things of God in this world. When you realize he could return at any time, all of a sudden, I'm not slothful concerning God's call upon my life and a desire to reach the world. The second effect that it produces upon the one that watches and waits is that it causes us to be pure in our lives in a way that might not otherwise be so. And so the one that is watching and waiting, expecting the Lord to come at any time, that is a person that keeps walking in the light, walking in purity, and those are blessings enough, even if it's not our generation that sees the return of the Lord, though I am watching and waiting for him. And so you see the two servants, the effect of watching and waiting in the one, the failure to watch and wait in the other. And I'll tell you, you carry it right into this age in any Christians today, and you'll so often see the same characteristics depending upon how seriously they take these things.